logged in? I would make
sure. I've logged in. Okay. Do you want me to? Would
yeah,
you go? Okay.
Yeah, because I need to. That way I can switch into your. Into mine as well. Can you get into yours if I log in?
Yeah. It's just a website.
You can log, you can do your website.
No.
Not working?
I don't know. I feel like I'm gonna. Okay. This is so awkward.
You're getting chairs even before you start. That's good news. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Hi, everyone. Hello. My name is Quincy, and I'm the vice president of USWIB, undergraduate Stern Women in Business. Next Friday, February 26th, we have our fifth annual conference coming up right here in Stern. I really want to encourage all of you guys to go or at least check it out. Tickets are only $15, which is incredibly cheap. Included in this price, you get breakfast, you get lunch, you get swag bags with like t-shirts from Google, Red Bull, a Bluestone Lane coffee card. Really awesome. And what's really special about our conference is we have industry panels from like everything you can imagine. We have finance, we have consulting, we have fashion, we have media. So whatever you're interested in and whoever, you know, contacts that you're looking to make, this is a great place to do it. We're also allowing our conference attendees to come in and out. So if you have any other obligations during the day, you know, $15 is worth it if you just want to come to the career fair or if you just want to make a panel or two. So this is a really amazing opportunity and I'd encourage all of you to go. Thank you.
Okay, so I'm going to start off with my, you know by now what the questions are going to be, right? So I hope by now, at some point I'll stop asking, but you got to help me on this one. First, is there anybody who's not part of a group yet? Okay, good. So that's out of the way. Everybody's part of a group, right? Who hasn't picked a company yet? Come on, be honest. Everybody's picked a company? This is good. Okay. So we're ready to go. So if you remember last week, we laid the foundations. Come up with a risk-free rate. Somebody help me out on the risk-free rate question. What's the risk-free rate? What's the risk-free rate right now? Don't answer the question till you ask me what. In what currency and over what time period, right? So if I ask you, what's the risk-free rate in U.S. dollars? The answer is? Over what period? Okay, good. You're asking, okay, if I ask you what the risk-free rate in U.S. dollars over a 10-year period is, come on. What are you going to use? You don't have to give me a number. What are you going to go look up? You're going to look up the T-bond rate. Hope and pray that there's no default risk in the U.S. Treasury. If I ask you what the risk-free rate in euros is, you're going to go use the German 10-year euro bond rate. Why? Not because it's Germany, but because you think it's the closest to default-free you can get in Europe. If I ask you what the risk-free rate in Indian rupees is, it's a little more involved, right? What do you have to do? You have to start first with the government bond rate in rupees, but you can't stop there. Why not? There's default risk in the Indian government, so you've got to figure out how much the default risk is. And there are three ways you can come up with that spread, right? Let's see how much you're keeping up with the class. If you can give me one of the three, you're on your way. If you can give me all three, I'll give you a prize. Okay, you're going to give me all three? Let's go. One is you can use the rating and do what? The rating by itself will give me an alphabet grade. So you can look up the, okay, so I'll concede that to you. So rating, and then you go to the lookup table, you can look up the spread. So one. The second is you can use the sovereign CDS for your country. If you there's a packet that I passed out today. If you didn't get it, I sent it as an email attachment. But I'm working on the assumption you never open my attachments anyway. So this is already an email. So if you did not get it, it's there. So don't worry about getting it in class today. You already have it in your email box. Those are updated sovereign CDS spreads. What are those? Those are market-based default spreads, insurance prices that you can do. So you can do the CDS. Let's get the price. What's the third one? You got close, so close. Somebody want to finish? So the first is you can look up the rating and the default spread in the lookup table. The second is the sovereign CDS. What's the third way you can get a default spread for a country? If they issue bonds in U.S. dollars, complete the story. What do I have to do then? So let's say I find a Brazilian bond denominated in dollars. But be specific. It's dollars, so you're going to compare it against the? No, you have to compare it. To make it risk-free, you have to compare it against a U.S. T bond of the same maturity. So if you find a 10-year Brazilian dollar denominated bond and you compare it to a 10-year U.S. T bond, you got the spread. Okay, actually, you win the prize. So I don't know what the prize is, but I'll think of something by the end of the class. I can't give it in the middle of the class. I have nothing in my hands. Look, you know. So we have three ways of getting the spread. You take the spread out of the government bond rate. You come up with a risk-free rate. The reason I spent so much time on the default spread is today that number is going to come back, not to haunt you, but in a useful way. Because remember, I also ended the class last week by talking about equity risk premiums, right? And again, intuitively, the equity risk premium is what you demand over and above the risk-free rate to invest in equities as a class. So I'm going to make a pitch again. The weekly challenge from this week is actually two tests you can take. It's actually kind of fun to take the test to see where you fall. So these are online tests you can take to see how risk-averse you are. So after they'll ask you like 20 questions, most of which are pretty simple to answer. At the end of the process, your risk score is 47. And relative to the rest of the world, this is how risk-averse you are. And we had our own variant of a test we did in class, right, where I said, you have everything invested at 3%. How much more would you need? And that, I said, was the equity risk premium. And then I talked about the first way and the most common way of estimating that equity risk premium, which is to look at the past. Look at the last 50, last 70, last 80 years. And I showed you a table for the U.S. going back to 1928. And I'll go back to this table because I might as well revisit it. That's the page I left you with. And I said, if you're going to use a historical risk premium, be consistent about what you call risk-free. Because I'm using the T-bond rate as my risk-free rate, the premium that I'm going to be looking at is the premium over T-bonds, not T-bills. I said, I'm going to use a geometric average because these numbers are going to get compounded over time. And then what did I say about how long you should go back in time? Did I say go back 10 years, 20 years, 50 years? How far back should you go? As long as you can. Defend it, though. Because somebody, let me play devil's advocate. You're at your desk and you say, I want to go back to 1928. And say, are you crazy? That was before the Great Depression. Market was different. Why do you need to go back as far as we can? What's the rationale for it? Diversifying is probably not the word I want to use here, though it is kind of a variant of the same theme. It is? Go ahead. Because it's the law of large numbers, right? Basically, if I have 10 years of data, the standard error is 8.66%. That's three times larger than my risk premium. So I need to go back 80, 85 years. And even then, I have a risk premium of more than 2% or a standard error of more than 2%. That's going to set the table perfectly for the next part of this process. In the U.S., at least I have this luxury of going back to 1928. Or maybe even to 1871 or 70. I mean, I could go back a long time. But I have an Indian company in my mix. I have a Chinese company in my mix. What if I have a Russian company in my mix? Do you see the question I'm going to ask next? How many years of historical data do you have for the stock market in China? Maybe 20 if you're lucky, and 10 of those you can't even count because it's really not really a market until you get to the early part of the last decade. If you're lucky, you have 15 years. You can't go back to 1928. There's nothing there. The Indian stock markets have been around a long time, but for much of that period, there were illiquid markets with 20 companies that got traded. So in Indian stocks, you probably have 20 to 25 years. With Brazil, maybe 25 years. Do you see where I'm going? If I came to you with 95% of the countries in the world, you don't even have this choice of going back 100 years. So if I ask you, what's the equity risk premium for India or the equity risk premium for China, you can give me one of two answers. One is you can say, come back in about 85 years, and I'll tell you. But that's not a good strategy. As a consultant, I'll suggest to you, if you give me that answer, I'm not coming back in 85 years. I'm never coming back. The second is you can say, I'm going to try to do something today. My suggestion is the second answer is the better one. But that's going to open you up to what do we do now? So what I'd like to start off today with is how I get an equity risk premium for all these other parts of the world where I don't have historical data going back 10, 15, or even 30 years. So I'm going to actually use something we've already done. And let me set up the table here. Now, I can get an equity risk premium for the U.S. Let's assume that's a base that I can get with the 86 years of data. Let's make up a number. Let's say it's 4.53%, which is what the historical premium was. And you say, I'm pretty comfortable with that number for the U.S. So let's start with an easy question. If you were investing in Brazil or China, would you expect a larger premium than 4.53% or a smaller premium than 4.53%? It should be larger, right? That was the easy part of the question. In case you're still struggling with it, it is larger. Why? Because the countries are riskier. Now comes the tougher part. How much larger? That's really what we have to start off with today. So I want a measure of country risk, right? And now do you see why I spent a few minutes on the default spread and revisiting it? Because that is actually a measure of country risk. It's a different measure of country risk. It's a risk of investing in the country's bonds, but at least it gives me a number to begin with. In fact, the state of the art, if you can call it this in investment banking, is you're done. Here's what you do. You take the U.S. equity risk premium. You take that default spread you got for India, China, or Brazil. Using what? Using whatever you chose, the CDS market, the rating-based spread, or a dollar-denominated bond. You take that spread and add it onto your U.S. equity risk premium, and that now becomes your equity risk premium for that market. So let's make this specific. In November of 2013, the historical risk premium for the U.S. was 4.2%. You say, why isn't it 4.53%? Hey, it's 2013. I didn't see what was coming in 2015. So this was the historical premium through 2013. My historical premium was 4.2%. The default spreads for India, China, and Brazil based on the rating was 2.25% for India, 0.8% for China, 2% for Brazil. So those are the same default spreads I took out of the government bond rate to get to a risk-free rate. They now come back into the picture. I add that default spread onto my U.S. equity risk premium, and I have an equity risk premium for each of the three countries. You don't like default spreads based on ratings? I can take the sovereign CDS spreads and do exactly what I did with the default spreads. Add the CDS spread to the US ERP. I have an ERP for the country. The one thing I would suggest is be consistent. When you did your risk-free rate, if you use CDS spreads there, use CDS spreads here as well. If you use default spreads based on ratings there, use default spreads based on ratings here as well. It's all going to be okay. This is why I don't want you sitting there with these three numbers for the default spread saying, which one do I pick? I don't care. Pick one and stick with it. As long as you stay with that number all the way through, it's going to be okay. It's going to work out. So the first approach to coming up with equity risk premiums for countries is start with the U.S. base from the historical data and build on top of it that default spread that you got by looking at the rating or the CDS or whatever approach you use for the default spread. Now do you see why I took this number out of the government bond rate? Because if I did not take this number out of the number, and I did this, which is what a lot of investment banks do, I've seen people value Brazilian companies using the Brazilian dollar-denominated bond rate as the risk-free rate and add this on to the equity risk premium. Do you see what you've done? you've double counted the same risk. Once in what you call the risk-free rate, but really included the same spread, and now you've added it back on to the equity risk premium. So it's to prevent the double counting that I want you to clean up your risk-free rate first and then do this for the equity risk premium. Any questions on this? So any AAA-rated country is going to have what equity risk premium? It's going to have the same equity risk premium as the U.S. If you're not AAA-rated as a country, so Germany is going to have the same equity risk premium as the U.S., Australia is going to have the same equity risk premium as the U.S., Singapore is going to have the same equity risk premium as the U.S., they're all AAA-rated countries. If you're not AAA-rated, my work begins. I've got to come up with a default spread and add it on. So 20 years ago when I saw investment bankers do this, I understood what they were doing, but I had a little bit of a problem, and I'll tell you what the problem was. These are the spreads for what? For buying government bonds issued by these countries, right? So you're saying if I buy an Indian government bond, I'm going to charge a 2.25% default spread. But what are you thinking about buying? You're not thinking about buying Indian government bonds. You want to buy Indian equities or Chinese equities or Brazilian equities. So let me ask you a generic question. Are equities riskier than government bonds in that country or safer? What's the essence of equity? You're the last guy in line, right? If the guy ahead of you is charging 2.2%, you better be worried and charge a little bit more. So my tweak on this approach, and this is just my tweak, and it's, I won't say it's derived because that'll give it too heavy a weight. It's my concoction. Is here's what I do. I say, look, I know what the default spread is for the government bond. I know equities are riskier than government bonds. If I can somehow measure how much riskier equities in China relative to the Chinese government bond, maybe I can adjust this spread for the additional risk. So I went looking for measures of risk in equities and risk in government bonds. Remember the mean variance framework? The mean variance framework, what measures risk? The variance of an investment, right? So I went back and I looked up two numbers in each market. I looked up the standard deviation in the equity index in that market and the standard deviation in the government bond in that market. So let me give you an example. In Brazil, the standard deviation of the Bovespa, which is the Brazilian equity index, is 21%. The standard deviation of the Brazilian government bond is 14%. Let's do an algebra problem. If you buy the Brazilian government bond with a standard deviation of 14%, you're demanding a default spread of 2%, right? But you're not buying the bond. You're buying equities, which has a standard deviation of 21%, which is 1.5 times more volatile than the government bond. I would expect you to charge 1.5 times the 2%, which is an additional 3% on top of the 4.2%. So my equity risk premium for Brazil is 7.2%. So standard deviation of stocks versus standard deviation of the government bond. I scale up the default spread. Now let's take India. 2.25% default spread, right, from the previous page. The standard deviation of the Sensex, which is the Brazilian, I'm sorry, the Indian equity index is 24%. The standard deviation in the Indian government bond is 17%. Do the same algebra. Scale up the 2.25% for the additional risk of equities. The equity risk premium for India is 7.8%. Then I start for China. Default spread is 0.8%. The standard deviation in the Shenzhen, the Chinese equity index, was 18%. The standard deviation of the Chinese government bond was 10%. 1.8 times 0.8% gives me 1.44%. That added on to the 4.2% gives me my equity risk premium for China. So start with the U.S. premium, get the default spread, scale up the default spread for additional risk. You got an equity risk premium for a country without history. I don't need a historical database here because I'm starting with the U.S. premium as my base. You might view this as very U.S.-centric. The way I think about it is if investors have choices, they can put their money wherever they can get the best return. You can't have each country have an independent equity risk premium that's unconnected to the rest of the world. Because if you give me a 2% equity risk premium in Germany and a 6% equity risk premium in the U.S., you know exactly what I'm going to do. I'm going to pull my money out of Germany and put it in the U.S. And therein lies a potential problem in India and China. How many people are from India or China? Okay. And I'm not, so if you think about, you're an Indian investor or a Chinese investor. You don't like the equity risk premium that you're getting in India. So I'll do India because I'm much more knowledgeable of what your choices are. Yeah, but so you don't like the fact that you're getting too low a premium. What did I say you're going to do? You're going to pull your money out of India and put it where? Germany or the U.S. You know the problem is? Both India and China restrict domestic investors from investing outside the country. It is a huge problem. In fact, it's one of the things at the core of the China problem is the fact that Chinese investors have not been allowed to move their money out of China, no matter what the prices are. Which means that the only escape hatch you have when you don't like things is to do what? Sell everything and put the money where? Into real estate. You basically have to go chasing asset class after asset class. You don't like stocks, you go into real estate in China. If you don't like real estate, at some point you're going to say, what if there's no place to go? God help you. Because that's the seed of a crisis. That's why you need to give investors choices. It will be painful because the first time you give them choices, they might say, I don't like the way Indian stocks are priced. I'm going to buy German stocks. And Indian companies are going to complain about the fact that their stock prices are down. But once they start competing in the global marketplace for investment money, that is the healthiest thing to happen. So is everybody comfortable with the process? U.S. base plus a default spread scaled up to reflect the additional risk of equity. But all of these risk premiums were built off that historical premium, right? 4.2%. So I'm going to go back to that 4.2% because I'm not comfortable with that number. Why am I not comfortable? Because it's a historical number. It's backward-looking, and it has that big standard error. I'd much rather have a forward-looking number that's more precise. So I'm going to take you through a process that I go through at the start of every month with the S&P 500, where I try to estimate a forward-looking equity risk premium for the S&P 500. You've all taken foundations, right? You all computed the yield to maturity in a bond at some point in time in your lives. Nod your head like this. Yes, yes, I have. No. You have. I know you have, even though you might not remember doing this. But somebody remind me how we compute the yield to maturity in a bond. What's the process by which you compute the yield to maturity in a bond? Want to help? Yield to maturity in a bond. You look like you knew it, so I was going to point to you. You want to pass it on, I'm okay with that too. Okay, so the price of the bond. Discounted what though? What do you discount? What are the cash flows on a bond? Your coupons and the principal. It is that discount rate that makes the present value of those cash flows equal to the price of the bond, right? It's an internal rate of return for a bond. So if you give me the coupons and the face value, I'll try different discount rates. There's some discount rate that makes the present value of the cash flows equal to the price of the bond. That's the yield to maturity on a bond. I'm going to steal that concept and try it out on stocks. Now, instead of buying a bond, let's say you bought the S&P 500. First, can you do that? Can you buy the entire index? Actually, now it's easy to do. There are spiders, there are index funds. So basically, you can buy the entire index. And when you buy the S&P 500, what are you getting in return for your money? You're getting not a bond, but the 500 largest market cap stocks in the U.S., right? So here's where we are. November 1st of 2013, I'll give you the updated numbers in a few minutes. November 1st of 2013, if you bought the S&P 500, it would have cost you $1,756.54 to buy the entire index. So instead of buying a bond, you've just bought the 500 largest market cap stocks in the U.S. Instead of coupons, what do you hope and pray you'll get as cash flows if you buy stocks? You're going to get dividends, and in the U.S., we're going to see this increasingly. You're also getting buybacks as part of your cash flows. I don't know what they will be in the future, but I can tell you what they were in the 12 months leading into November 1st. That cash flow would have been 82.35, and you can see the bulk of it actually came from buybacks, not dividends. So collectively, you'd have made 82.35 as your cash flows in the last 12 months. That doesn't help you much, right? Because you want cash flows in the future. So I'm going to give you the final piece of the puzzle here. The S&P is the most tracked and followed index in the world. There are actually analysts whose job it is to track the entire index, forecast earnings for the index, and forecast growth rates. November 1st of 2013, that expected growth rate in earnings for the S&P 500 was 5.59%. So now let me try to bring these all together. Your cash flow last year was 82.35, right? If you believe this growth rate, those cash flows should also grow at 5.59%. So 82.35 growing at 5.59% gives me 86.96, 91.82, 96. So those are my expected cash flows in the next 5 years. You think, what happens after 5 years? Well, these are the 500 largest market cap stocks in the economy. They cannot keep growing at 5.59% a year forever. Why? Because the economy is not growing at 5.59%. So at some point in time, I've got to turn the tap off. Turn the tap off in what sense? I've got to bring the growth rate down to the growth rate of the economy. And I'm going to use my proxy for the growth rate of the economy. Because there are a couple of ways you can get the growth rate of the economy. One is you ask economists. Biggest waste of time, biggest waste of money ever. Because they have no idea what they're talking about. So you'd be charged a lot of money. They'll give you a number. But you don't trust it further than you can throw it. So I'll give you what I use as my expected growth rate in the U.S. economy, and it's going to depress you. Right now, anybody have the Wall Street Journal today? I can tell it. I can give you the second decimal point on it. Anybody have it? No? Come on, guys. This is a finance class. Somebody should have the journal with you. I see a few Daily Mails, New York Post. No? Right on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, every day, you get a number that tells you what the growth rate of the economy is. You know what it is? It's a number we've already talked about. What did I say the risk-free rate in U.S. dollars was? The T-bond rate, right? And what did we say the T-bond rate was roughly right now? About 1.7%. You're saying, what's that got to do with growth rate in the economy? I don't know whether you remember that econ class we talked about the Fisher equation. Do you ever talk about the Fisher equation? You say, who the heck is he and what's his equation? It's actually a very simple equation. The Fisher equation says that the nominal interest rate in any economy is a sum of two numbers, expected inflation plus an expected real interest rate. No massive insight here, but it actually just breaks down interest rates, real interest rate. What's a nominal growth rate in the economy? It's going to be expected inflation and an expected real growth rate, right? Think of the two equations. The risk-free rate is not expected inflation plus a real interest rate. The nominal growth rate in the economy is expected inflation plus an expected real growth rate. In the long term, expected real interest rates and expected real growth rates have to converge. Why? Because when I promise somebody real interest rates, I've got to deliver goods and services. That's basically what real interest rates are. And if I'm not growing at that rate, I can't deliver. Now do you see why I said it was going to be depressing? So what's the bond market saying the nominal growth rate in the U.S. economy is going to be for the long term? 1.7%. You say, oh, that's awful. Get used to it. Just be glad you're not in the Japanese economy. Because what's the T-bond rate in Japan telling you about the nominal growth rate in Japan? Could actually be negative. That's why negative interest rates are not a sign of strength. They're a sign of weakness. Low interest rates are actually inconsistent with a vibrant, growing economy because the bond market is saying, this is what I think the economy will do. You can bitch about it, you can moan about it, but it is what it is. So after 5 years, what I did was I lowered the growth rate in my cash flows to 2.55%, which was exactly the T-bond rate. I'm almost home. So here's what I have. I know what you paid, 1756.44. I'm sorry, 54. I have my expected cash flows for the next 5 years. That's last year's cash flow growing at 5.59%. Beyond year five, these cash flows keep growing. For how long? Forever. Don't let that intimidate you because it's part of the economy. It's like a very long time. And I capture that effect with this last equation, which is like a present value of cash flows forever. It's a growing perpetuity equation. I'll come back and talk about it. Essentially, it allows you to bring in forever without having to keep writing. I mean, can you imagine how many terms you have to keep writing if you wanted to write forever as an equation? You'll never get to the end. So this allows us to put closure. And then what was the question I asked with the bond? What discount rate makes the present value of the cash flows equal to the price of the bond, right? I ask exactly the same question. What discount rate makes the present value of these cash flows equal to 1756.54. It's a little messier as an equation, but I use the solver function in Excel, or the Goldseek function, or whatever function you want to use. And November 1st of 2013, that number was 8.04%. You're saying, what does that even mean? If you bought stocks on November 1st of 2013, I don't care what you hoped you would make, what you prayed you would make, what you thought you would make, given what you paid for stocks, you could expect to make 8.04% a year. Risk-free rate then was 2.55%. You subtract the 2.55 from the 8.04. The equity risk premium at the start of November 2013 was 5.59% in the U.S. You're saying, how is this different from the 4.20% we saw as a historical premium? That was a backward-looking number. This is a forward-looking number. Do you see why it's forward-looking? It's based on the expected cash flows in the future. This number has error attached to it because my growth rates could be wrong, my cash flows could be off. The standard error in this number is about 0.25%. 0.25%. What was the standard error in my historical premium? Do you remember? It was 2.29%. I've traded a forward-looking number for a backward-looking number. I've traded a premium that has a 0.25% standard error for one that used to have a 2.29%. I don't see how I can lose. I've got a forward-looking premium that is going to change almost constantly because every time the market changes, the premium will change. Yes? Well, this is the entire economy. This is the economy. 500 largest market. You're not talking about an individual company, right? We're talking about the 500 largest market cap stocks. It is effectively 80% of the economy. So if it were an individual company, this is a debate worth having. You can say no company is going to grow at the rate of the economy. It's probably going to shrink. But with 500 largest market cap stocks, might as well let them grow at the same rate as the economy. Okay, the question was, how much is that terminal value going to a lot? Does that bother you? Should it bother you that 80% of your value comes from the terminal value? Don't let it. Because when you buy stocks, when do you make money? Assuming you bought the right stock. If you bought Twitter, this question becomes almost irrelevant, right? You're never going to make money, you know, not this life. But if you bought a stock that went up, you didn't make money while you held the stock. So if you bought Tesla 2 years ago, congratulations, you made a lot of money. But you didn't make it while you were holding the stock. It's going to come when you sell the stock. When you buy stocks, you make money from price appreciation. So if you bought Google at 200, congratulations. But you haven't made any money yet because they haven't paid any dividends. You're going to make money when you sell it at 600. That's when I'm going to say, congratulations, you made $400. He's saying, but I made all my money on price appreciation. Don't complain. That's why we buy stocks. So you're right. A big chunk of the value is going to come from that price appreciation component, which is what the terminal value is. If it didn't, I'd be worried. So that's an implied equity risk premium because I'm backing it out of the S&P 500. So now let me complete the process, and then I'll come back and show you what this number looks like today and how to make sense of, is this a good number, a bad number, a high number, or a low number? So let me go back to November of 2013. I had some choices to make. First, I had to decide what I was going to use as my mature market premium, and I had two choices. I could go with that historical premium, which at that time was 4.2%, which I didn't trust. Or I could go with my implied premium, which was 5.59%, and let's round it down. This precision is kind of a false precision. Let's make it 5.5%. And it's a forward-looking, more precise number. To me, it was a no-brainer. Putting my faith in that 4.2% seemed to me asking for trouble. So my base premium for the U.S. is going to become 5.5%. And then I'm going to do exactly what we talked about. For every other country, I'm going to build off that 5.5% by coming up with a default spread for that country, if it's not AAA rated, and scaling up that default spread for the additional risk of equity. So let me show you what the world looked like in November of 2013, how I'm going to use it for my companies, and then we'll kind of update the world as it looks like, as it looks today. So to get my equity risk premium, I'm going to start with my U.S. premium. I'm going to get the implied premium. That premium is going to become my base. If your country is AAA rated, Germany, Singapore, Australia, Norway, Sweden, I'm going to use the U.S. premium. And I'm going to say they're mature markets. They should have the same premium. If your country is not AAA rated, I'm going to go look up a default spread in the CDS market. You take your poison. And I'm going to scale that default spread up to the additional risk in equities. So November of 2013, this is what the world looked like to me. So this is my twist on equity risk premiums. So essentially, you're going to see first 5.5% for the US, but 5.5% for Canada, for Germany, for Australia, for Singapore. And remember why. They're all AAA rated. If they're not AAA rated, I look up the default spread. And you can take Asia and look across Asia. And you can see the equity risk premium. So the first column is my total equity risk premium. The second is what I'm adding on to my US premium to get to that total premium. So if you look at, let's say, Malaysia, the additional risk premium I'm charging for Malaysia is 1.95%. Added to the 5.5% gives me 7.45%. For Mongolia, 6.75% is the risk premium for Mongolia. So if you're thinking about investing in Mongolia, let me know. Okay? My equity risk premium then, 6.75 plus 5.5 is 12.25%. So essentially, it's 5.5% plus the additional premium. I have the equity risk premium for pretty much any country which has a sovereign rating. Does every country have a sovereign rating? Not really. There are about 20 countries which don't have sovereign ratings, and you're saying, what risk premium should I use for those countries? My advice is a really big risk premium. Like, what are those countries? Syria, Afghanistan. In my updated table, I'll show you, I actually have risk premiums for those countries. I gave it my shot. Because let's face it, there are people in. I got an email today from a business person in Syria. There's actually one last guy left in Syria. I know what he's doing there. Eh? And he said, no, I have to come up with a hurdle rate. This guy's worrying about hurdle rates in Syria. I said, come on, get it. Yeah, this guy must be in a little bunker somewhere. No, nothing's happening above him. No. He said, can you come up with a number? And I actually was able to give him a number. I don't know what's going to happen with this number. I hope that nothing bad happens, but no. So this is my November 2013 world as it looked. You say, why do you need this? I have six companies, right? One is a Brazilian company. You say, why don't you just stop with six countries? Okay? Let's see why this is going to make a difference. The equity risk premium for your company doesn't come from the country in which it's incorporated. It comes from where it does business. So to me, this seems like common sense. If you're a U.S. company, you're Coca-Cola, you get 60% of your revenues outside the U.S., I shouldn't be giving you a U.S. equity risk premium because you're a U.S. company. Your equity risk premium as a company should reflect where you do business, not where you're incorporated. So let's take Disney. U.S. company, headquartered in Burbank. But if you look at the breakdown of revenues in 2013, 82% of their revenues came from the U.S. 11.6% came from Europe. 6% came from the Asia-Pacific region. 0.33% came from Latin America. I was actually shocked that it was that low from Latin America. My equity risk premium for Disney as a company is a weighted average of those four. The U.S., of course, is 5.5%. You're saying, how do you come up with a weighted average for Europe? I took all of Europe, and I weighted the equity risk premiums of each country by the GDP of that country. Why? Because I want Germany to be weighted more than Portugal and Europe. It's a big, and same thing in Asia. The weighted equity risk premium for Asia should be weighted disproportionately towards China and not towards Vietnam. It's a different economy. So the risk premiums that you see in the last column are the weighted averages for those portions of the world. You're saying, why don't you break it down into countries? I have to take what I'm given. This is how Disney breaks down their operations, and I'm glad they at least do four. You know, U.S. companies have this very bad habit of breaking revenues down. I was doing Facebook yesterday. I just valued Amazon and Netflix. And both companies, which have substantial international operations, this is how they break their revenues down. They have U.S. Guess what the other one is? The rest of the world. Come on, guys. The rest of the world is a really big place. Could you start being a little more specific? All these accounting changes, all these little things that nobody cares about. This is disclosure that actually matters. But an amazing number of U.S. companies still act like U.S., Rest of the world. For all I know, rest of the world could be Lithuania. Or rest of the world could be China. Rest of the world could be Germany. We have to push companies to be more transparent about where they do business, because without it, you can't value these companies. Yep. That's the other question. Why did I wait by revenues? Again, you take what you can get. Most companies report only revenue breakdowns geographically. Some do break down operating income by region, but I wouldn't trust that number further than I can throw it. You know why? Ireland is always the most profitable part of the world that you operate in. Maybe it's got something to do with that 12.5% tax rate. But once you go below the revenue line item, you have all these other games that are being played by companies. So the first reason is revenues are available for most companies. The others are not. Second is even when they give you numbers below revenues, you should be a little wary about what's driving those numbers. Third, revenues are the only number a company can give that are always positive. Do you see why it's going to be an issue? If you broke down EBITDA by region, and you said, and in fact, this was true for both Amazon and Netflix. They have 55% of their revenues in the U.S., 45% outside. They reported revenues and profits. But they actually make money in the U.S., they lose money outside. The Netflix, for instance, loses outside the U.S. Do you see why that's going to create a problem? If I create weights based on operating income, I'm going to have 171% weight on the U.S. and a minus 71% weight. It's a lot. You can't sell short the rest of the world, which is what you'll end up with if you use anything other than revenues. You'd need the countries then, right? You'd basically need the countries. So basically, if they gave you a breakdown by individual country, you could do it. I don't know whether it's worth the effort, unless you have a... See, I'll tell you when this is going to get you into trouble. If you get all your revenues in Asia and Vietnam, and I'm giving it a weighted average equity risk premium, I'm going to underestimate your equity risk premium, because I'm acting like you get the bulk of your revenues in China. So that's when you have to worry, is when a particular country that's not a big country accounts for a big chunk of your revenues, then using these weighted averages for the regions can get you into trouble. So any questions for Disney? So that's my equity risk premium for Disney. Let's look at the rest of my companies. Bookscape, I got lucky. Why? It's a New York bookstore. So basically everybody walks in is a U.S. customer, so I just use the U.S. equity risk premium. When would this not be true if you ran a New York bookstore that catered only to Chinese tourists? I don't know how this would even work. Okay? Then you would perhaps have to think about other countries, but here I feel okay using a U.S. equity risk premium. Vale, Brazilian company, right? Is it? Let's look at the breakdown. Vale's biggest market is, China. Vale is a Chinese company. We just never knew it. You're going to see this in a lot of companies. You're going to be working in a company that you think is a U.S. company, and suddenly in the middle of your research, you're going to discover that you've been working on a Chinese company without even knowing it. It can happen because that's where you do business. So there's the breakdown. The equity risk premium for Vale, based on its revenue exposure, is 7.38%. Tata Motors? Almost. Largest market is India in 2013. But in 2015, if you looked at Tata Motors, guess what its largest market was? China. Now do you see why the China crisis has the tentacles that it does? China slows down. It's not China alone. Vale slows down. Tata Motors slows down. Disney slows down. Apple slows down. The biggest reason for Apple reporting flat revenues last quarter was China. China is there. So anytime you're in an interview, you don't know what the answer is, just say China. As I said, it'll work almost every single time. Why are rates going down? China. Just make it sound profound each time, you know, as if you know what you're talking about. Because there's a seed of truth there, no matter what the question is, that China is responsible. Okay? Why do you have a stomachache? China. Right? Whatever it is, China usually is the answer. So try it out, right? Now, for Baidu, China is always the answer. Why? It is the only company here which has all of its exposure in China, because as I said, I've never talked to anybody who's not from mainland China who's ever used Baidu. In fact, most of them never heard of Baidu. 100% China. Deutsche Bank, Germany is its biggest market, but you can see it's pretty much spread out around the world. Weighted average equity risk premium reflects where it does business. So the key of this table is for you to think about this. When you pick a company, don't look at just its incorporation. Look through its annual report, its 10K, whatever the financial statements are. Somewhere there, there'll be a breakdown. And some companies will be pretty good about their breakdown, breaking down regionally. Some will do what Amazon and Netflix did. Take what you can get. That's all you can do. And try to compute an equity risk premium for your company. Now, until 2008, I used to compute the implied equity risk premium for the U.S. at the start of every year and use it through the year. So I'd estimate on January 1st of 2007, I'd use it for the whole year. 2006, I used it through the whole year. In 2008, I planned to use it through the whole year. And my excuse was, it's a mature market. How much would equity risk premiums in a mature market change during the course of a year? And you should never ask these questions because that's like asking for divine answers right away. Because in September of 2008, I discovered how much equity risk premiums in the U.S. could change during the course of a few months. So this is actually a graph of the equity risk premium by day for the S&P 500. Remember, each day you can do this equation over and over again. You say, how much can it change in a day? Well, take a look at that graph. So it starts on September 12th of 2008, which was a Friday. And I remember it vividly. I was going home at 4 o'clock. Why was I going home at 4 o'clock? I go home whenever I feel like going home. So that day felt like going home early. So I was going home at 4 o'clock. I was listening to the news, and there's this news story that comes through. It said that Lehman was in trouble and was looking at Barclays as a potential buyer. My first reaction was, that's bad for people who work at Lehman, but it's one of those firm-specific risks. Lehman goes, you know, has in trouble, but one day we'll wake up, Lehman's stock price will be down, a few other stocks might be affected, not the end of the world. I went home, spent the weekend, come in on Monday, and it was the end of the world. That was the start of the 2008 crisis. If none of you were in the market during that period, I know, unless you're precocious 12-year-olds or something, you know, working on the market, 15-year-olds. But it was every day. I kept a journal each day because every day I discovered things I never thought could happen. Things like rates going negative. GE not being able to issue commercial paper, largest company in the world. And the market would move 1,000 points during the course of a day. It'd be up 600 by midday and be down 800 by the end of the day. The S&P 500 would move 7% during the course of a day just because people were panicking. And every morning, this was my punishment to myself, is I would compute the equity risk premium at the start of the day. Just say, how much could it change? I started on September 12th with a 4.37% equity risk premium. So I did exactly what you saw in November of 2013. I did on September 12th, 4.37%. So you see this green number? That's the equity risk premium by day. It's rising from 4.37%. In fact, there was a day in November. This is 2 months later, where the equity risk premium in the U.S. was higher than 8%. So what was the question I said? How much can equity risk premiums change in a mature market in a year? Well, there's my answer. It can change a lot. There are lots of things I do differently post-2008. And one of the things I do differently is I no longer compute the equity risk premium January 1st of each year and say, what can happen over the course of a year? I know what can happen. So each month, at the start of the month, I compute the equity risk premium for the S&P 500. In fact, I'll send you the spreadsheet that I use. It's pretty simple. You can do it yourself, right? It's just a solver function, and you click the solver, it gives you the updated premium. But if you're too lazy to do that, you can go to my website on the front page of my website. It'll give you the equity risk premium at the start of the most recent month. If you're too lazy to even do that, there's another option. You have to thank my daughter for this. It's about 3 years ago. No. I'm sitting at home minding my own business, which is what I usually do. I don't say my room because I don't have a room. I have a little corner of a bigger room, which is supposedly mine. So I'm doing that, minding my own business. My daughter busts into the room. She never walks in. She never waltzes in. She busts into the room. She said, Dad, do you have a Twitter account? I said, Kendra, I don't. She said, Dad, you're so old. And then she walks out. Why you would state the obvious and then walk out, I don't know. But after she walks out, I'm really pissed off. Why do you walk in, call me old, and then walk out? So I get on to Twitter, and I say, how difficult can it be to create a Twitter account? So I create an account. I forget all about it for 6 months. She busts into my room again 6 months later. I said, Dad, do you know you have 1,000 followers on Twitter? I said, what? What are they following? I've never tweeted, Twittered. I didn't even know what the right term was. 1,000. So I checked, there are 1,000 people following somebody who never tweets. I said, if you're following me, I have to give you something to follow. Start of every month, guess what I tweet out? The equity risk premium for the S&P 500 just hit 6.55%. It blazes through the world. Not. But this has become my end game. This is one of the things I keep. My revenge on my kids is I'm always going to have more Facebook friends, more Twitter followers. Now, basically, you take any social media, my objective is to have. So on Twitter, my quest is all about the numbers, and you can help me here. Each month I try to add to my numbers. And I got to 15,000 about a year and a half ago. I was so proud of myself. Until the stupid python escaped from the Bronx Zoo. Did you ever hear about this? The python escapes from the Bronx Zoo, and somebody creates a Twitter account for the damn python. And in 2 weeks, the snake had 16,000 followers. Here I am, working month after month, getting people to sign on. In 2 weeks, a snake beat me. So since then, my objective is I have to get ahead of the snakes of the world that escape. Last week, I hit the 50,000 mark. In fact, somebody in this class was the 50,000th follower. I gave her one of my little books, $15 books. It was not $100,000, $50 book, $500,000. But now it's all about the numbers for me. So here's what I want you to do. Go join Twitter. Follow me, then block my tweets. I don't care if you read my tweets. I just want numbers. If you have 5 email accounts, put them all on. Join me. If your dog has an email account, let it be a tweet. Twitter has no idea who the followers are anywhere. Dogs, cats, rats, guinea pigs, whatever you have. Put them all on the list. I'll take the numbers wherever they come from. As I said, my end game is very simple. I want to get up to 1 million followers, then 10 million, then 50 million. I want to be like Kanye West. Of course, my tweets will never be bleeped out. Have you seen his tweet feed? Half the words have to be covered up, blank things. So at least you know what the equity risk premium is at the start of every month. Okay? So I hope my sales pitch, I'm going to check the numbers this evening. I want to see at least 100 increase or 200 increase by the end of today. So you know where to go. Now, let's update the number. So we're now in 2015. Clearly, I can't keep using the 2013 number. Start of January 2016. I'm sorry, 2016. Start of January 2016, there was the S&P 500. 2043.94. Wasn't that long ago, but it feels like forever already. I did the implied equity risk premium. The start of January 2016, the implied equity risk premium, using exactly the same approach that I used in November of 2013, was 8.39%. You subtract out the T-bond rate that day, 2.27%. The implied equity risk premium at the start of January 2016 was 6.12%. That was, 7 weeks ago, right? So I'm going to ask you a question about direction. What's happened to the S&P 500 since January 1st, 2016? It's down about 10%, right? 8% maybe. Cash flows haven't changed that much because, you still haven't updated. Growth rates have decreased a little bit. But the big change is the S&P 500 is down 8%. The T-bond rate, which was 2.27%, is now 1.7%. So you have lower T-bond rates. Now, what do you think's happened to the equity risk premium over the last 7 weeks? Has it gone up, gone down, and remained unchanged? Good try, but go the other direction. Same. Think about a bond, right? When a bond price goes down, what happens to the interest rate on the bond? It goes up. When stock prices go down, holding cash flows fixed, your equity risk premium is going to go up. At the start of February, the equity risk premium was almost 6.5% in the U.S. My guess is we're roughly about there still. You think, is that a high number? Is that a low number? Is that an average number? Let me give you some perspective. This is the implied equity risk premium for the S&P 500 going back to 1960. So I want to show you this graph because when you look at the 6.5 and you say, is that a high or a low number? This is what I wanted to compare it to. Implied equity risk premium in the U.S. between 1960 and 1970 was between 3 and 3.5%, much lower. Then you get to the 1970s, something seems to be happening, right? The implied equity risk premium is shooting through the roof. Is that a good thing or a bad thing for stocks? If implied equity risk premiums go up, what did we say happens to stocks? They go down. In fact, in 1978, the implied equity risk premium in the U.S. was 6.5%. The Dow was at 750. Three numbers in the Dow. Think of it. Scary thought, right? 750. It's at, what, 16,000 now? In fact, I think it was Business Week or Forbes that had this cover article saying stocks are dead, which is usually a good contrarian indicator for when you should be in stocks, because starting in 1978, you're in one of the great bull markets of all time. So the equity risk premium drifts down. In fact, at the end of 1999, the peak of the dot-com boom, the implied equity risk premium in the U.S. was 2%. You know why that should scare you? Remember that survey I did in class last week where I asked how many people would settle for 0 to 2, 2 to 4? I think there were two people in this entire class who said they'd buy stocks if the premium was 2% or less. The rest of you looking at the 2% would have said that number is too low. And when you say the equity risk premium is too low, what are you telling me about stock prices? They're too high. What's the definition of a bubble? Is when you tell me you think you're going to make 7%, but then you price stocks to make 2%, only bad things can happen to you because your expectations are out of line with reality, and reality doesn't adjust to expectations. Expectations have to adjust to reality, and that, of course, is what happened in 99. You had the dot-com bust. The equity risk premium drifted back to 4%. It stayed around 4% for 5 years, that period of false security where I felt I had it covered. Then you've got the crisis. And since the crisis, since 2008, equity risk premiums have become incredibly volatile. And I'm afraid that's the way it's going to be for your working lives. You know why? We're globalized. You're saying, so what? What's the essence of globalization? Is a crisis in any country is now a global crisis, right? You have 170 countries. So if you think that once the Chinese crisis is over, everything's going to be hunky-dory, let it go. There'll be another crisis and another one and another one. This is the reality you guys will have to work with for the rest of your lives, which means you've got to be much more dynamic about the way you estimate equity risk premiums and be more willing to keep changing that number as the world changes around you. So that's my equity risk premium, 6.53% right now. Is that a high or a low number relative to history? It's a high number. So if next time somebody says there's a market bubble, what's your best counter to that? What did we say a market bubble was? When the equity risk premium gets really low and you think you're going to make a high premium. This is not 99. So I don't care if a guy with a Nobel Prize says it. It doesn't make any sense in this market. If you think this market is going to go down, it can't be because you think it's a bubble. It's got to be something else that's driving it. Maybe it's a crisis. Maybe it's lower growth. But this market, the premium that we're in, is actually a higher number than we've seen historically, which is counter to what you'd expect in a bubble. So here's my January 2016 country risk update. It looks a lot like 2013, but notice the box up on top. These are called frontier markets. You're saying, what are those? Those are the markets that nobody even dares to rate. Okay? So you got Algeria, Brunei, Gambia, Guinea, Guinea-Bissau, Guyana, Haiti, Iran, Iraq, Korea. That's the other Korea. The Kim Dong-ju, Kim Jong. Obviously, a very risky place to be investing in. I would suggest strongly don't think about investing. Syria, Somalia, Sudan. He said, how the heck did he come up with risk premiums for those countries? I cheated. I don't have a rating for those countries. That's what's historically prevented me from doing it. So I used a proxy. There's a service in Europe called Political Risk Services that gives you a numerical country score for every country. I'll send you the link to them if you want. They're on my website too. Basically, they have it for 175 countries, including the frontier markets. So I looked up the country risk score for Syria, which has the highest country risk score of any country right now. No surprise there. Then you know what I did? I went and looked at my rated countries for which I had risk scores and tried to find one as close as I could get to Syria. Then I looked up the risk premium for that country and I said, that's my risk premium. You're saying that's stretching? If you have a better way of doing this, I'd be glad to take it. This is desperation time. I don't have a rating. I don't have anything else. I have to come up with my best proxy. I think I've pretty much got the world covered now in terms of risk premiums. Of course, I have to keep updating these numbers because the world keeps shifting under me. Okay. This is the most downloaded data set by far on my website. Its biggest selling point is it's free. That's a big selling point. But it gets downloaded in the strangest places. I'll give you an example. Get an email from the New Zealand Milk Board, even though there's a milk board in New Zealand. They were using your country risk premiums to set milk prices for New Zealand farmers. Who the hell are you selling the milk to? Zimbabwe? Yeah. So I keep reading, what's going on? So he said, can you explain how you come up with the risk premium? So I have a little PDF file. This is what I do. I start with the US. So I do what this class is. Basically, I send them a YouTube video of the class. Another chance to teach the world, right? Or get more Twitter followers. Usually I put the Twitter thing. Make sure you join my Twitter account just in case. No? Or you can on Google track where your, or on my website, track where your followers are coming from. Or where people are logging onto your website. And usually the culprits on the top 10 list are all pretty standard. I can tell what they're going to be without even looking. The US is number one. Then you have India. I guess last names kind of, you know, maybe this guy knows something. They, you know, that allure kind of draws it in. And nice to have a billion people kind of thinking you know something. And then you have all the English-speaking countries, Australia, UK, Canada. And then you might have, you know, Russia. But for the last 3 years, Lithuania keeps showing up. So what the hell is happening in Lithuania that they keep coming to my website? And it turns out that the Lithuanian, the government resources board, actually, when they ask for bids on contracts in Lithuania, require people to use my country risk premiums to come with the numbers. Lithuanian, so maybe I'll get a little Lithuanian sausage or something as a gift. Nothing yet, no. But once in a while I do get an email I have no idea how to respond to. I'll give you my least favorite email of all time. It happened in April of 2009. I get an email from Lebanon. I don't get that many emails from the Middle East on valuations. I'm very excited. I open up the email and here's how it begins. You have destroyed Lebanon. I said, what? How the hell did this happen, right? I mean, I can see myself destroying Liechtenstein or Luxembourg or one of these quasi-European countries you can walk through in 15 minutes. But Lebanon, after 25 years of Hezbollah and civil war, I'm the guy who destroyed Lebanon. So I said, what did I do? And the email was from a Lebanese business person whose business had been appraised for value. And the appraiser had used the country risk premium for Lebanon from my website to come up with the value. You're saying, what's the big deal? See this 14.2% that you see there? That was 16.5% in 2009. You see why this guy was pissed off? You put in a 16.5% risk premium, your discount rate gets really high, the value you get gets really low. He felt he'd been gypped, and it was all my fault. My first reaction was, hey, talk to your appraiser. He's the guy you're paying, not me. But then I did remember the email was from Lebanon, and I said, I have to be a little more careful about how I respond to this email. I have to find somebody else to blame. Now, remind me again how I come up with these premiums. I start with the U.S. premium. I can't blame anybody for that. Then I look up the rating for the country, right? So if your rating is in the toilet, you're going into the toilet with it. So I said, it's not my fault. It's Moody's. Fault. And if you want their address to put in your GPS, here it is. And I sent them the address. Nothing's happened at Moody's yet, right? So the guy was not that pissed off to do something about it. But all I'm saying is there's no intellectual firepower behind these numbers. I'm not sitting there saying, oh, do I love Brazil? Should I do some research? It's all based on default spreads that I scale up, right? So I'll make that confession up front. I am not a country risk expert. I don't want to be a country risk expert. But the one thing that this table has going for it is it's completely transparent. You can see where it's coming from. You can take it or leave it. But it's going to be the building block I need to do almost everything in corporate finance. Yes?
I want to ask about the equity risk premium for Abu Dhabi and for China. Why are they separated from the country?
That's a good question. In fact, I was in Dubai 4 weeks ago, and they said, how come Dubai has its own risk premium? Because each part of the United Arab Emirates actually has a different rating. And the reason is very simple. United Arab Emirates has all the oil and all the cash. So if you're lending to Abu Dhabi, you should feel really good about your lending. You're lending to Dubai, you're actually at the mercy of Abu Dhabi. In fact, there was a problem a few years ago with the Dubai ports, right, where people thought that they automatically would get the backup from Abu Dhabi, and they didn't. So you actually get different ratings for the different countries. You're saying, how come we don't do that in the U.S. and say, because you don't have the same phenomenon. Puerto Rico is going to be an issue. And in fact, that's part of the reason. You can say Puerto Rico is part of the U.S. How come you don't just give it a AAA rating? Because if it defaults, it doesn't have the same degree of shelter you would get if it were truly part of a sovereign of the U.S. as a sovereign borrower. Right? So that's part of the reason you do the breakup. So what I want you to do with your company, this, of course, all presupposes you're going to pick a company at some point, is once you pick the company, you see why I keep prodding you to pick a company? Because now you can go look up the annual report right away and say, you can do it while it's still fresh. And I'll let you use my risk premiums from January 2016. You don't have to update it. You don't have to do any fancy stuff. Just look up the regional breakdowns and see if you can come up with a risk premium for your company. Yeah. You're saying, what if they have the rest of the world? Actually, I have the entire spreadsheet with all the risk premiums. You can do a weighted average of everything but the rest of the world. So I'll send you the risk premiums for everything other than the U.S. The rest of the world, it's like 7.39% as a geographical weighted average, and you can use that for the rest of the world. But that's where these numbers are going to feed in. Now, I know that we're getting to the end of the class. You're ready to go, but I'm not ready to leave you. So I'm going to get started on the third and final number that I need. So at this point, we have a risk-free rate, right? It depends on what currency you do the analysis in. I have an equity risk premium for your company based on where it does business. This is the third and final number that I need. I need a beta. In fact, when I go into investment banks, sometimes I go in and do re-education programs for bankers. What this is basically are experienced bankers who've forgotten basics. So once 10 years into the job or something, they get these bankers together, and none of them wants to be there. I say, can you come in and talk a little bit about... So I go into this room of bankers who use betas every day for 10 years and ask them a question. Where do betas come from? One guy actually tried to explain to me where babies came from. I said, no, I think you missed the question. Where do betas come from? And they look at me like I have two heads. He said, what do you mean, where do betas come from? They come from Bloomberg. I mean, the reality is, on the desk, that's where betas come from. You never actually estimate betas. Once you start working, you look them up. And I said, no, where do betas really come from? And some guy from some deeply repressed memory of a class from 2 decades ago, isn't it some kind of a regression? Yes, it's a very simple kind of regression of returns on the stock against returns on a market index. The slope of the line is the beta. That's the way I was taught betas. And perhaps in foundations, you probably did betas. This is the way you were probably taught betas. Horrible way to think about betas. It's the way we're all taught betas. Run a regression, slope of the line is the beta. In fact, when you run a regression, the slope will tell you something about the risk of the company. It's a beta. But when you run a regression, you also get an intercept, right? Think of this as a statistics class. You run a regression, you just don't look up the slope. You look up the intercept. I'm going to argue that intercept tells you something about how good or bad your stock was as an investment over the period of the regression. So what are you talking about? Netflix and Amazon did incredibly well last year, and over the previous year as well. If I run a regression for Netflix and Amazon, the beta will tell me how risky these companies are, but the intercept is going to tell me that these stocks did much, much, much better than the rest of the market over that period. So the intercept tells me something about performance. And finally, if this were a statistics class and you ran a regression, you also get this R squared, right? Somebody want to remind me what an R squared in a regression tells me? The percentage of the variation in your dependent variable that is explained by your independent variable, right? So that's statistics. This is finance. What's your dependent variable here in this regression? It's the stock. What's your independent variable? The market. So the R squared tells me the percentage of the risk in my stock that is explained by the market. Is that significant in some way? What was the second step in every risk and return model in finance? We divided risk into risk that is company-specific and the risk that comes from the market, right? You know what the R-squared tells you? It tells you how much of the risk in your stock comes from the market. Why does that matter? That's the only portion of risk that you actually get rewarded for when you invest in a stock as a diversified investor. So we're actually going to set up the regression. We're going to use the slope as our measure of risk. We're going to stop and look at the intercept because, as I said, the intercept is going to tell you whether your stock was a good or a bad investment. And here's what we're going to do. If you look at the traditional CAPM, the return on a stock is a risk-free rate plus beta times RM minus RF. That's the equation that drives it. If I do a little algebra, I can actually rewrite the CAPM as the risk-free rate times 1 minus beta. I promise you I'm not messing with the equation. I'm just moving terms around. Plus beta times RM. So that's the CAPM. There's a regression equation that I just ran. Intercept plus slope times RM. Compare the two equations. Second term cancels out. And if my stock did exactly as predicted during the period of the regression, you know what the intercept should be? It should be equal to the risk-free rate times 1 minus beta. When I run this regression for Amazon and Netflix, what I'm going to see is the intercept is about 20% higher than the risk-free rate times 1 minus beta. You're saying, what does that tell me? That these stocks did much, much, much better than I expected them to during this period. That's what separates a good investment from a bad investment. In fact, the difference between the intercept and the risk-free rate times 1 minus beta is called Jensen's alpha. You're saying, who the hell is Jensen, and why do you attach his name to it? Jensen is a guy, is Mike Jensen. He actually is one of the fathers of finance. He worked at the University of Chicago, and this is a measure he created in the late 60s to answer a very simple question. In the late 60s, the prevailing wisdom was, if you invested in a mutual fund, those were professional money managers. They must beat the market. That was the assumption. Because they know more than the rest of us. And he asked the question, is that true? And when he asked the question, people said, why are you even asking that question? Of course it's true. Otherwise, how would they be professional money managers? He said, let me just check it out. So he took 125 mutual funds, which was the entire universe of mutual funds then, and he computed the Jensen's alpha for each one. Remember what I said, the Jensen's alpha is positive, your stock did better than expected. If it's negative, you did worse. If it's zero, you did exactly what the market expected. So the question he was asking was, do professional money managers have positive Jensen's alphas? In one of those findings that stayed pretty much constant over the last 50 years, here's what he found. Out of the 125 mutual funds, 85 had negative Jensen's alphas. The average Jensen's alpha across all mutual funds was minus 1.5%. This is the strangest profession that I can think of. I'm going to give you the analogy. This is like starting a plumbing business called Floods or Us. And what I do is you have a leak in your house, you call me and I leave a flood. You won't be in plumbing very long, right? So what are we doing? We're paying professional money managers to do what? Deliver 1.5% less than what we could have made by not paying them. Let your brain get wrapped around that concept. And the next time you walk into the Fidelity building, think of what that has done. That's that big building that your money has built. This is not a class on active money management, so I'm not going to go there. But that's the Jensen's alpha origin. So I'm going to end with this last piece. I want to run a regression. I've got to make some choices. What kind of choices? I want to get a beta for Disney, right? Simple. Run a regression for Disney against the market. Here's my first question. Over how long? Disney's been a publicly traded company for almost 60 years. I could run a regression with 60 years of data. Why might I not want to do that? In statistics, more data is better than less data, right? So use 60 years. Why? Disney is a different company. 1956, Disney had no theme park. Disneyland was being built. It produced one animated movie every 3 years. It was more like, I know, Lionsgate, right? Which is, you know, it's Hunger Games, one movie every three. That's what Disney looked like in 56. I want a beta for the future, not the past, so I don't want to go back too far in time. So that's the first choice. How far back do I go? Second, once I decide I'm going to go back two, maybe three, most services use 2 to 5 years, I have to decide how I'm going to slice up the data. You're saying, what are you talking about? Take 5 years of data. I could take 5 years of daily data, which would give me 1,250, 1,260 observations. 5 years of weekly data, which will give me 260 weeks of data. 5 years of monthly data, which would be 60 months. 5 years of, so I can take the same 5 years and have very different time periods. Again, it's a trade-off. If I go too fine with daily data, I get a lot of noise in my data. The trading might not always happen at the end of the day. If I go too broad and go with quarterly data, I don't get enough observations in my regression. Most services use either weekly or monthly. So that's the second. Third is I have to run a regression against the market, right? What index should I use? What are my choices? I can run it against the Dow 30, the S&P 500, the NYSE Composite, the Wilshire 5000, the MSCI Global Index. I think at last count, when I went on to Bloomberg, there were 125 indices just for the U.S. Which is the best index to use to get a beta for your stock? If I have Apple, should I run it against the NASDAQ because it's in the NASDAQ? Well, that sounds like a logical choice. What's this beta for? It's for the CAPM, right? And in the CAPM, what do we all end up holding? Think about that mythical word we created. No transactions cost, no private information. We all ended up holding what? The market portfolio. What's in the market portfolio? Every single traded asset in the world, the closer you get to that, the better your index becomes. So now do you see why you don't want to use the Dow 30? Too few stocks. Why not the NASDAQ? It's really a tech index, right? You take out Apple and Google, what's left in the index? In the U.S., the default index becomes the S&P 500. It's only 500 companies. It's the 500 largest market cap. But even then, you've got to ask, why U.S.? There's nothing in the CAPM that says only domestic stocks are foreign. So you can actually see the tension that's being created as we become a global market about what index we should use. So we'll come back and wrestle with that because it's going to make a difference. And finally, we're going to run the regression. So we'll start the next session with that regression.